Welcome to Wabanaki Windows. I'm your host, Donald Loring. This series will focus on the hidden elements that have influenced Wabanaki history from the invasion of our shores in the 18th century to the land claims and beyond. Today, we will be talking about the hidden element of blood quantum and the influence it plays in the development of our tribal communities, membership numbers, and our very identities. This is a highly controversial subject, and we realize there are no easy answers. We can only give you a glimpse of history and our perspectives. My guests today are Professor Darren Ranko, who is a member of the Penobscot Nation, Professor of Anthropology, and Chair of the Native American Studies at the University of Maine. Our special guest today is Morgan Talte. He's also a member of the Penobscot Nation and an award-winning author of Night of the Living Res and his latest book, Fire Exit. Morgan is currently teaching creative writing at the University of Maine. Welcome to the show. As I always like to do, we will start our conversation on blood quantum by looking first at its history and then what we perceive as its present and future effects on tribal identity. Okay, Darren, could you start us out on this topic of blood quantum and, you know, maybe give us a little background, a little history?
Sure. This is a difficult topic for Native people to engage. I think it's so firmly associated with our identities at this point that it's one of those, like, how do you decolonize your mind and how do we come up with a way to represent ourselves that comes from who we are? Very clearly, blood quantum is associated with European notions of race and racial theory and racial prejudice. The first sort of law in North America associated with this comes from 1705 in Virginia, from the English colony in Virginia, and they were defining mulatto. So the idea is that and they were defining mulatto as a way to limit the rights of people who are in this racial category, preventing them from holding public office. So they were already trying to, like, associate this with the whole complex of race, right? So of Negro, right, as African American or Black, right, and Indians, right? And so very early on, this idea of blood quantum, even quantifying blood, comes from an English common law tradition, but that stretches back, you know, even before 1705, hundreds of years in sort of English common law and notion. So it is very clearly not a representation that comes from us as Indigenous people. This is a hugely colonial framework. You know, I think the hardest question to answer, perhaps, and this is, you know, because, like, you could ask the question, why has it persisted? You know, and I think that's the harder kind of piece to answer. I will say this, and sometimes people think I'm defending blood quantum when I say this. I'm not. I think the system is clearly colonial in its nature. But I think one of the reasons why it persists beyond, and I think we'll talk probably about sort of trauma legacies within Indigenous communities that sort of allow it to persist. But I think the other thing, even in a positive way, is that as a way to talk about our identities as Indigenous people, blood quantum can fill in very important ways to kin. So kinship in a colonial American English context, that blood is a biogenetic substance that is measured or doled out. It can stand in for what I think most Indigenous people would say is key to their identities, is who are you related to? I wrote my whole undergraduate thesis at Dartmouth, Morgan, on this question of who are you? You know, like that idea of, especially growing up off the res, you know, as I did in Orono, like people identifying you, asking you, who are you? And they're asking you, who are your grandparents? You know, who are your great-grandparents? It, but in some ways, Blood Quantum does fill in a little bit for that. It orients us towards kin and relationality, again, in very colonial ways. But I think it's one of the ways, it's one of the reasons why it's hard to shake, I think, for our communities, because it can, in everyday parlance, become a fill in for kin. In kin relations. So I think, I think us, that's one of the challenges, us trying to untangle that from these very clearly colonial origins to the contemporary day where we actually can control. We could get rid of Blood Quantum tomorrow, right? As Penobscot Nation. I don't see us doing that tomorrow, but I do think that there's a vibrant discussion to be had.
Yeah. So, but let's not forget the land connection here, because I really believe there's always a land connection. And back
Totally.
in the 1700s, I think was it 1705, when Virginia decided they were going to look at blood quantum, they decided, well, okay, one drop of blood will define who a black person is,
Sure.
because they needed people to work. They needed slaves.
Yes.
So that sort of enhanced that ability for them
Yeah.
to have workers.
Oh yeah, but Virginia is the great. I mean, each successive like iteration of this, Tanya, as you know, like if you were to do the full history of it, and like I looked again at some of this work, but you're exactly right. It becomes tied to all the other forms of racialized dominance brought by settlers to Turtle Island. So it absolutely, and yeah, you can look at the one drop rule that sort of really burst in Virginia. There's a whole other set of conditions where the what I would consider the more sort of regulatory sort of modern context start, which starts more at the end towards the end of the 19th century in federal Indian law. You can even see the roots in Virginia in the 1860s, where they're doing blood quantum for Indians as using the one quarter rule, which is, gains great steam towards the end of the 19th century, becomes sort of implicated in federal law at the end of the 19th and early part of the 20th century as well. So I think Virginia is a great case study for all those reasons too. It sort of becomes really wrapped into that
So,
history.
I know you're roaring to get in here, Morgan, but I just have one more thing to say.
Yeah.
And that is, the quarter blood issue or the status comes when they want to deplete our numbers. They want to take away, see us disappear, because we it's our land. And so if we're inconveniencing them because we are on this land. And so, what's the cheapest way to do it? What's the cheapest way to get, Native people off their land so that the majority culture can take it over? And the one of the best ways to do it, easiest way, cheapest, is the quarter blood status, so that eventually our people will just disappear. Morgan, what do you get to say?
Lots of things. A lot of points that were brought up about land and its relationship to blood quantum and blood quantum today, as being kind of like how do we tell people we're native, right? How do we suggest it, or show it, right? It's what's interesting is, a lot of people, you can look at someone and you can be like, oh, that person is such and such, just because of the way they either look or the way the way they dress. There are identifying factors, right? The way they talk might give it away. And we've all been surprised, I think, to encounter somebody who we think is somebody or belongs to a specific group and they're not, right? But they that comes about through some way, right? It might be a way they talk and they don't speak English or something, right? And I think for Indigenous people, it's like not always the case. It's very mixed, and it's we don't dress in traditional clothing, but you go to Google and you type in Native Americans and images, all that pops up is Western Plains natives from a long way back wearing regalia, and So I think about like that idea, Darren, because it's a good point. It's like it's you know what do we have to suggest to tell the world who we are when we're not just on the reservation? Yeah, it was a double-sided coin. On the one hand, it was for to keep sort of slavery, to keep the divisions of make it so African people, no matter how remote, and how regardless, and I'm quoting here a bit from a historian, Patrick Wolf, who's saying, a phenotypical appearances, makes a person black, right? And he went on to write, for Indians, in stark contrast, non-Indian ancestry compromise their indigeneity, producing half-breeds, a regime that persists in the form of blood quantum regulations, as opposed to enslaved people whose reproduction augmented their owners' wealth. Indigenous people obstructed the settlers' access to land, so their increase was counterproductive. In this way, the restrictive racial classifications of Indians straightforwardly furthered the logic of elimination. So it was a way for them to grab land. It's because it's like we look at Maine, for example, and we look at how Congress had blocked the transfer of land, right, from the Non-Intercourse Acts of the 1790s, and it was, that was happening anyways, but it was all about land. I think they came up with this idea to make us go away without making us go away. This is the strangest thing, because it's like my son, he's a descendant, but like he's not considered native. And if he has children, well, if when he has children, they'll be descendants of descendants unless something changes. And it's like, but he's still native. Like, if you think about like lineage, right? If you think about it, but I feel like it even goes deeper than that because some tribes who don't use blood quantum in, Darren, I think you hinted at it talking about the 70s with, I think you were alluding to Santa Clara Pueblo versus Martinez case, yeah, in which a woman, sued the Santa Clara Pueblo, or basically the question was, is she had children that were fathered by somebody not in that tribe, and she wanted to enroll her children, but they're a patrilineal society, and so they were like, or they had adopted patrilineal descent as a way to for eligibility reasons, and they were like, well, no, because the father is in a Santa Clara Pueblo, and so the children were thus not allowed on to be considered Santa Clara Pueblo. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and I think the Supreme Court said it's an open-ended question still, right? I'm pretty sure they just said, like we can't get involved. This is a matter maybe for Congress, I think is what they usually default to, right? But that's, they handed it off there. But think about it that way. Even in a patrilineal, we're not using blood quantum, we're using patrilineal way, there's still a sense of suffering, right? Or a sense of injustice for these children. So it's blood quantum, but it's also related to, I think, a lot of other factors, and it's Western ideology. The way, we don't have to go very, very deep, but thinking about like John Locke principle, capitalism, all of this stuff, I think, plays a huge role. In talking about blood quantum, but for me the question is, it always goes back to what Darren said. It's like, we could change it at any time. We could change the rules, and it's like, what happens if we do that? It would be interesting because we could shape it. I mean, people get afraid of losing money, right? Like their per capitas are going to disappear, right? But it's like, no, we could frame it where it's like, okay, people all who are already citizens retain their per capitas for right now. You know what I mean? And we build a structure and we put rules in place, or I have no idea, right? But like if that had happened, it would be fascinating to see what the United States' reaction to it would be. Like imagine if we'd populated all of our lands with like citizens of the Penobscot Nation that were technically enrolled. And our numbers went way up, and like just it was like a futuristic society or something. But like, imagine that type of power and strength. I don't know. It's an intriguing thing, and I don't think the United States is. I don't think they would take that very lightly to see something like that, a massive growth and a new way of a tribe reinventing itself and pushing itself forward outside the confines of what they have, because they threw the machine into place and it's just running, you know, in Indian country, and we're walking by it, and we can see the off switch, but no one wants to kind of like touch it, I don't think, or like start to work towards getting to that off switch.
Yeah. Now, Darren, do you remember in the transcripts, I believe it was the Attorney General's discussion where they were talking about, oh, well, you know, if in fact they had like 400 members of the Canadian tribes come down here, then they could be on the tribal rolls in this state, and then we'd be responsible for their well-being too. We'd have to pay for them. So, so they, you know, the whole purpose of this quarter blood status thing is to eliminate tribal members, keep the numbers down, and eventually eliminate us.
Well, so, and that's you know, as I mentioned, that was sort of starting at the end of the 19th century, those very explicit framework of extermination of indigenous people. It was part of, you know, allotment, right, and the federal policy. But, you know, you see this in Maine, as you mentioned, in the 40s, 1940s, through that transcript. But, you know, they are reflecting ongoing understandings, and they reference these as well, like they had already been influenced in terms of Canada, the Indian Act. They were already talking about the terms of the Indian Act, which removed, you know, citizenship from by outmarriage of a woman, right, a native woman to a non-native man. Like, and then they were contemplating that, remember, through one of the other transcripts of saying, well, what if we did it both ways? Like any outmarriage, like
they
just
ended up doing that. They
yeah.
Ended up, yes.
Yeah. And so that. Right. So that becomes then the thinning blood model of termination is so intimately tied to forced assimilation and, erasing in Native people. Right. And for all the reasons that we know in terms of solving the Indian problem as the quote unquote frontier closes at the end of the 19th century into the 20th century to kind of, you know, get rid of any of those legacies for at that time, again, always about land and other things. Well, you know, they were trying to push through all sorts of crazy, you know, development schemes on Indian lands, and which they basically do. If you look at uranium mining, or you look at any of the third things that happen only on Indian land, starting in the late 19th century, early 20th century, forms of mining, forms of all sorts of things that the, you know, that assimilation and that works to do. You know, I think one of the things that's always interesting to think about, and I was, because we were talking to Morgan today, was how blood quantum can cut both ways in terms of this disabusing of it. And I used to teach Mean Spirit by Linda Hogan, which is basically a book about allotment you know, in terms of like having access to the rights, you know, the oil rights, the monies from oil in Oklahoma. And what's interesting is that they use blood quantum logics to disabuse people who are either full blood or mixed blood, right? So there's this interesting part of that book where, you know, they show up one week and they'd be like, oh, well, you're mixed blood. You don't have, you can't get your cash for the oil revenues this week because you're mixed. You're not really a whatever, you know, you're not really this person. And then they're like, so you can't get it. And then some point later in the next chapter, they show up like 2 months later and it's completely reversed. It's like, you're full blood. We can't allow you to have this money because you don't know what to do with it. Right. So it cut both ways, literally, like by, you know, and we see this, as you know, Donna, in your work with your partners on One Nation Under Fraud. Like, they make it so it works both ways to their advantage, right? I mean, that's sort of how the power in these situations operates. And the idea that on the one hand, as I pointed out, we're recognized as Indians, not tax, which is a kind of thing that recognizes on some level our sovereignty, but it quickly becomes just another mechanism for them to disabuse us of our rights, right? So it just puts us outside of the system, and they get to define what that outsideness gets to be at any particular moment in time. And that's sort of through various fraudulent schemes that the state of Maine in particular has come up with in the last 200 plus years. But yeah, it just that's what I think people who are unfamiliar with the frameworks of blood quantum, they don't see. They can see the diminishing, oh, we're going to breed ourselves out of existence kind of frameworks to it, but they don't see how it's been so directly manipulated in the last 150 years by federal and state governments to basically take from us. Like, and that's like the overwhelming evidence around it, as again, asking the question, why do we persist in using it ourselves, right? So, yeah.
Well, the other piece of that is we do their dirty work for them. We're saying it's like we're taking the gun. Hey, give me that gun. I'll do it myself. We're getting rid of our own people. I don't know if it's Stockholm syndrome or what it is, but I think that what happened was that you only have so much pie. So you guys have to figure it out. And here's a way to do it. This is how you can get more. And that mentality has sort of taken root in our tribal communities, and it's really infested us so that we're fighting each other. And now, we're finally seeing what the heck's going on. And we are sovereign, and we do have that right to decide who's a tribal member and who isn't. And it is time. It's time for tribal communities, or at least ours, to take a really close look at how this is affecting us and has affected us and will affect us in the future. Morgan.
Donna,
Yeah.
I've just been thinking now. I was thinking about, how many. I'd be curious to dive into it, but I'm thinking of the Oliphant versus Suquamish Indian tribe, or Indian tribe, and the case that ruled that tribes didn't have the power or inherent sovereignty to try non-natives who committed crimes in Indian country, which is ridiculous, right? If you think about it, but they took that and away from all the tribes, and which led to, I think, one of the biggest reasons there's so much violence against Native women today, because of that decision, which was partially overruled. We talked about this, I think, recently, Donna, but was partially overruled by, Obama reauthorizing VAWA, the Violence Against Women Act. But then we look at, Maine's Settlement Act, and it's like, well, does that, nobody, the last thing is like any law or bill passed for the benefit of Indians does not apply to Maine tribes, and there's something like, unless specifically stated. And I always say, I'm like, nobody's sitting around being like Obama didn't sign it, and then they walked away, and he was like, wait a minute, come here, and like put in Maine tribe, like that doesn't happen. And so, for us, we're confined to this document that makes no sense for us, but makes all the sense for the state in a way. And just to, I could go on and on and bring in Louise Erdrich's work and, the Roundhouse and the way she uses the law to propel a narrative, a character-driven narrative about justice and injustice and, ways of retribution, all sorts of things. But when it comes to, numbers, right, thinking about like a population wise, it's always fascinating to look at the court case for Oliphant, because they have a footnote in there. It's the first footnote they have in there, and it's and I can't exactly recall why they have it in there, but they found that, they had all this acreage that they got from, when they were recognized, and it says that 63% of it is owned in fee simple absolute by non-Indians, and the remainder, 37%, is Indian-owned land subject to the trust status of the United States. And so there's like this speculation that there's almost like, it's like, who's the minority here, right? Like in this area, and like it's almost like the tribes were saying, I mean, not the tribes, but the court, looked these took into consideration. Well, it's like, oh, well, there's fewer natives here, so this is just my rationale, because none of these court cases ever make any sense. It's just like they're like, well, there's fewer natives here, so why would we give the fewer the more power, and obviously that's not their whole logic that they go through, but it's just a strange thing to put as a footnote like in there. And I'm not quite sure if they come back to it, but it is it's a way to take and take and take until colonization gets what it wants. And I think of it more like, we always say, I think the synonym, I always think the synonym we use is like just white people. God, white people have done this and white people have done that, and it's true from like a genetic and, the way they look and sense, but it's the thinking that's been embedded, right? It's the ideology that, somebody started and it kept going, right? And it's like, what happens if we push against that ideology, right? And it's like, now it's no longer white people, but rather this virus that you're, a bacteria that has like affected the way we're thinking. Because I've always, the question I'm always that deeply concerns me is like, when I write fiction, is like, how do we forgive, how do we forgive, right? Like, is the biggest thing, like, how do we forgive? How do we welcome back into a circle, somebody who's been banished, right, for reasons that we don't know how to deal with. And I feel like that's the case with most oppressed people. It's like there's this intense anger with white people, which is fair and adequate, right? But it's like the thing within them that is driving the logic, and also driving our own logic, because we've internalized a lot of it. Indigenous communities have, adopted the attitudes of the colonizers, right? Like, by the fact of using and not wanting to go against blood quantum or turn that switch or make a different way, we're implicitly, buying into the idea of killing ourselves slowly. But every once in a while, we're able to catch ourselves, like, oh, our numbers are dropping, we have to, lift the census up a little bit. But some tribes get in trouble when they try to go out of the way. There's a group, I think, in somewhere out near the Great Lakes area. I don't know, Anishinaabe. There's a tribe I heard about recently that they kind of went their own way with how they were doing eligibility or something, and it's not going too well for them right now. But yeah, I just think of like, how do we, and for me, it's education. Education is the biggest thing. It's like, education at, sure, academics, but making it like publicly accessible is the thing, and understandable. Huge projects. I don't know who and how or when something like that could ever get done, right, to reverse that way. But ever since, the West came over here, it was two conflicting ideologies, right? You could see it in language itself. I mean, there's a word in one of the, I think it's one of the Sioux dialects, ni and I. It just means, it's interchangeable. It means the self or the land, right? Depending on the context. I mean, the Penobscot language, I feel, makes the same use of that. At least I've made the argument, thinking about Punawapskek, right, as being a location. But when we say, a person, we'd say Panawapskewi, and obviously when it was created in a written word, it's one word, it's a suffix at the end. We drop part of it, I mean, yeah, suffix. And so it's one word denoting a place and a person. So for, to me, it's a shared thing. Whereas in English, it's like, I am a Penobscot person. There's always a separation, right? There's always that space in between. And so you see it ideologically, and you see it all throughout history. People not knowing what to do with the land when they got their allotment, and then they lost it when the 20 years had passed or 25 years had passed, and they were to be taxed, right? They didn't know what to do because they didn't see the land as exploitation. They saw the land in a different way. And I'm not saying we have to go back to that, but we have to think of, like, how do we break the system down and find the right tools. I don't know. Now I'm thinking of Audre Lorde, right? You know, it's like the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house or something along those lines. And it's like, maybe blood quantum's the answer. I don't know, like using it as a way, or our power to shape it is, I don't know. Because that's a tool that, like, blood quantum is a colonial tool, but our ability to use it and how we use it becomes our tool. You know what I mean? Like, if it goes uncontested, so to speak. I don't know. My head's just writing a novel itself, envisioning a population. Yeah, just envisioning down the road. Like,
so here, you know, the thing is that,
fantasies.
You know, that we're, since the fact that we're sovereign, we can look at history. This is where history is important. We look at what happened in the past. We certainly don't want this to happen again and keep happening. So we've got to stop this cycle. And the way we do that is through education and understanding how we got here. What do you think, Darren?
Yeah, you know, and I've made this argument, I mean, specifically. So let's think about our nation, Penobscot Nation. You know, we do some things that I think reflect our culture and tradition. We include other Indian blood, which is pretty novel out there. People, and I think, you know, it points to one of the basic absurdities of blood quantum, which prefers in marriage situations where our tribes, and part of what built our confederacy was outmarriage was the preferred thing, right? So you marry, you actually the tradition of marrying someone from another major settlement or community is part of our traditions. And to include that in our kind of blood quantum framework that we still use at Penobscot is, you know, you could call it progressive, or a tap of the, you know, a hint towards a traditional thinking. So there's that. We've also, you know, I think both of you know, like we did change, right, in the early 80s and the early 1980s, we changed the base roll date from 1860 to 1880. Passamaquoddy uses 1900, by the way. So base roll date, for anyone at home who doesn't know that, that's basically the census upon which we presume everyone is 100%, and we apply the colonial logic of blood quantum as starting from that date. You know, I think that's, that, what does that show you? It shows you that this is not a fixed thing. All right, we are in total control. But you know, I don't know how many of our tribal citizens think about or know those factoids per se. You know, I think obviously we would need a pretty important and deep conversation across our community. Feel like some people have tried to start that at different times, you know, to be like, let's transform this, let's rethink this. You know, I think it's also its own, you know, for some of the things that Morgan mentioned, is its own third rail. You know, it's its own political death trap for one of our tribal politicians.
Yeah, but not only that, Darren, it's cruel. It's cruel and it's abusive.
What, that's right.
It's really, it's shameful what we've done to our own people.
Yeah.
And I can say that because, you know, I'm old. It's like I remember when they kicked this census, this law into effect in the 50s. They had to take it back, but what they did was they made the like if you're 17 or 18 and you were not quarter blood, you could not live on that island. You had to leave. So, and my cousins, my first cousins, who I grew up playing with, playing games with, and who really had a sense of belonging that this is where their home was, their family.
And as you know, that's when a number of Rankos also left.
Exactly. I'm saying, this really deeply affected us and affects us to this day.
Totally.
And we need to recognize that.
But I would say, Donna, I think what's I agree with you. I 100% agree with you. I think part of what I was trying to identify in terms of the political third rail around it is thinking about how people who are living right on Indian Island at the time through the 70s and then early, during the Settlement Act time, and then how disruptive it literally was, and then how it was perceived to be so disruptive after the Settlement Act of people returning and, disturbing a sense of community that people felt very precious about, and I think with good reason, and feeling like outsiders were coming, like so that is within this memory, and part of the a very real, like I'm not willing to just dismiss like what that impact is and what that feels like for a community to undergo this idea of outsiders, even though they're your relations coming back, and what that means. So I think,
No, I mean, we've internalized this. We have internalized.
I 100, and I think that we've internalized it too for a lot of the things that we've talked about on this show, which is, the forced sense of scarcity and believing ourselves to be paupers in our own lands, in our own right, like
Yep, exactly. And
that
where did that
framework.
come from? Where did that come from, Darren?
Yes. And that's imposed upon us so clearly by the state of Maine
The
through
state
a
of Maine, who's
successor.
actually living off us, off our wealth,
And they
they're
convinced
the
us
paupers.
we were living off them. I know it's absurd. It's
Crazy.
so angry making, and the idea that we would take that in, and then now we're using that to make, in part, the decisions about who we are is infuriating and quite.
It is infuriating. They have no right to define who we are. We do. And we haven't, I don't think we've decided really taken all the information that we can possibly take in. I don't think we've decided that yet. I think that's yet to be looked at. And that'd be a tribal decision. Absolutely. When you start thinking about, okay, how many thousands, hundreds of members did they get rid of? What size tribe would we be right now? Would we be a couple thousand and just us? 4,000, 5, 10,000? How many?
No, we have no idea how many descendants are out there right now. Like if we opened it up,
Exactly.
mean, 10 to 20,000 could come in. You have no idea.
But
Everyone's
you
having
don't. I
five,
mean,
six kids elsewhere.
And so there are studies for that, Darren. I mean, you're the academic here now.
Hey, Morgan's an academic. He's
I'm a
a
lowly novelist. No.
rebound.
what's the name of the study that you have to do? Would it be what is that? Is it like an economic demographic kind of thing?
Sure. Of course. And no, there's a whole host of ways to study that, and tribes who have, as Morgan pointed out, tribes who go into it, and are trying to address these citizenship, types of issues are the ones who really plan for it, and are able to kind of explain it and articulate it, and not sort of have it as a like, oh, part of tribal politics where like enough of us are now empowered to change this thing that we've always wanted to do, and we're going to just do it. Kind of situation, like, they're able to manage that. My prediction, I almost no one agrees with me, but I actually think what might happen before we get rid of it is I actually think people would be more comfortable with changing the base roll date than getting rid of 1/4, just in my sense of things. I mean, that has
And
some of
that's
the
the
same.
easiest solution. Yeah, I mean, it's the easiest.
Yeah. I think
But that, Darren, if I've decided to do that, that's their sovereign right.
yeah, correct.
Yeah,
Absolutely.
with all of the information that they can gather, and make that decision, I'm good. I'm good with that. But it's something they've got to look at, and they've got to understand why. You know, how much our numbers have dwindled and why.
Yeah. It's and I actually feel like we're, we've been on the verge of negative population, right? So, if you look at our census over this last decade, it's teetering kind
Yeah,
of.
and worldwide, they're not having as many babies as they used to.
Correct. Yeah.
So we're like, you know. We need to be futuristic here, and there are tribes. I think I'm not sure which one it is, but I know there's a tribe in Canada that decided they were just going to open enroll without blood quantum or anything else, just open enroll. I don't know how that went. I don't think it went very well, but you know what happens in that case is you just kind of homogenize yourself. You blend into the majority culture, and you are no more. So you got to be very careful of that stuff.
Yeah, I think the one you're thinking about that's sort of recent, on this is US side though, Minnesota Chippewa tribe. They voted to remove blood quantum, and that's been really bumpy for them. So just
There, but
FYI.
there, but you know, we talked about there are other ways. You don't need blood quantum. There's descendancy, lineal descendancy, that sort of thing, which
Juggling.
I lean towards that, you know, lineal descent.
I mean, that's the thing, is like it could be anything, really, right? Like, I mean, like I'm joking when I say juggling, but like if you could juggle four balls and you're a citizen, you know what I mean? Like that could be the measure. Like if you can canoe or how to, like there are so many things that you can put into place, like to determine eligibility. Like, right? Like, what do we do though with, like, if we do descent, like patrilineal, matrilineal, or just direct descent from either parent? Will we still run into the issue though that we still face today, right? Because if Santa Clara Pueblo, was following a matrilineal one, then they get, they've fallen in this trap where it's the machine's still running. It's like, yeah, it's so much planning and so much thinking that has to be done, I think, to get it right. And that's where none of us probably have the ability to do it, but children growing up, aren't, the youth coming up are the ones that are probably going to have the best ideas, right? Because they're living in the contemporary, and I'm thinking of, it's been so long, since the building's been gone, the community's.
Yeah. We're losing you on your
When
freezing.
there used to be, the youth. You hear me now?
No.
I mean, it's, I mean, I think Morgan's, really saying about that sense of community and what that means and how we handle our citizenship slash participation in our community. I think, yeah.
I think we have to really look at who we are. We have to be able to identify who we are, and and because we can't really decide on qualifications and that all of that unless we know what do we want, who do we want to be as tribal members. It shouldn't. I don't think it should just be blood quantum. I think there should be more than that. And even if it's just lineal descent, you know, but this blood quantum stuff, I think it's suicide. That's my position on it.
Yeah, just, that raises just the question of citizenship in general, you know, not just with for tribes, but like for countries, right? Thinking about, you know, you're born in America, you're an American, you know, you're born on American soil, you're considered American, right? And you know, how has that worked? You know, just thinking. I mean, America has tons of issues, right? From that colonialist way of thinking, and it's like, how do we get away from it is the problem, right? It's like, how do we get away with it at, how do we get away from it and develop new ways of thinking at the same time as putting into law, which is again, you know, associated with colonialism, at least as we're using it, right? It's like, how do we completely not sever the tie, but you know, slowly thread away, you know, the strings of, you know, this, you know, thick rope, right? How do we make it until we're left with one little string and then we snip it and then finally we're in like all like a brand new world in a way where it's like people are living, but that will take, you know, for, I mean, hundreds, I mean, thousands of years for something like that to occur, to happen. It's just like,
Yeah, I think this challenge, Donna, is like, because I just had a conversation similar to, and I have these conversations all the time on Wednesday, and I always feel like I'm like I raise this question. I always put it out as a question, and people think I'm defending something because I'll say something like, "Well, now, you know, the way this is handled is through, you know, chief and counsel, like we'll handle issues around sort of like our intellectual property or our knowledge system, you know, like how to negotiate an MOU with a university, right, to protect our culture and our knowledge and that sort of thing." And I'll be like, you know, but that's, you know, perhaps there are other ways, you know, and it, they seem very hard to establish. And then someone was like, "Well, that's not the community, the chief and counsel." And then I'm like, yeah, I know. That was like, I was pointing that out. Like, that's not an endorsement. I was just saying, like, that's what happened. Because when you say that's not the community, how do we then collectively as a community come together? I mean, we literally have these general meetings that not a lot of people go to, and I haven't been to one in years,
Exactly.
you know. But I mean, okay, let's say we don't want chief and counsel. Like, what's your alternative here? You know, what is the framework, you know, and I'm just, you know, the Minnesota Chippewa tribe, they came up with a resolution they wanted to put out as a vote, you know, get rid of blood quantum or not, right?
Forget
But that,
about.
well, I just to say, you know, that's one of the things that you're asking for, Donna, is like, how do we even come up with a set of solutions in our communities that make sense where there could be buy-in and education and the kind of framing around that. And I think that would require some real sort of very proactive kind of approach to how we generally think of how our laws come into being and are presented at a, you know, general council and then are voted. You know, like I think we need to say like we're going to have this as referendum and build up the education. You know, I think we need to be very thoughtful and
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just gonna add, it's I feel like the whole conversation we've had today, you know, which has been great, I think lives on this kind of hinges on the assumption that prior to colonization things were perfect, you know. And I think that's, you know, an important thing to acknowledge. Always, I think, even when we start the conversation about trying to, you know, fix the issues we face today, is that, you know, Indigenous communities weren't perfect. You know, we had our problems, we had our ways of, you know, dealing with them, but even then they still sometimes failed. And so it's a human condition issue, right? You know, it's a matter of the heart of like, how do we get things right? And that's what the West always saw, you know, when they didn't come over to these lands, right? They got these, you know, utopian, perfect utopia, right? That's what they saw. And I don't know, I was just thinking for a moment, I was like, we got to remember that not to have that view either, right? That we're not looking back that there was a perfect world ever in existence. Maybe it was before humans were created, but but like knowing that that is also a problem, that our own, that I think each society suffers from its own attempts to be good, right? And it's just a difficult thing. And yeah, I just, for people who are listening, I wanted to know, because I know both of you, I think we all implicitly understand that, is it's like we know it. Going back isn't perfect, right? But going forward, we can find a better way to create a more perfect system. So.
I do want to just say too that, people that say, well, that's the tribal council and chiefs, not me. Well, they kind of are, because you voted them in. They represent you. They are our government and our leaders. So, get a grip. That's what I say. Go ahead, Darren. I see you're going to say something.
No, I mean, just yeah, I mean, I welcome the opportunity. To me, that criticism and this urge to include community, I share that. It's just like, let's have the next part of the conversation, like let's have the solution part. I agree with you, like that's an imperfect, we didn't really create that. You're like, so what's your, like work with me here. Like I pointed out what I considered maybe a not the best way, but and then it's sort of like, well, that's something we have to address collectively, is like the solution part. And then that's why I was saying, like, we need to understand enough about ourselves to be like, how would it, like, what would a legitimate, community-based process for creating a new citizenship law at Penobscot Nation look like? Let's start from there. Not start the process from like what's politically feasible or why do we hate this thing, but like let's take it to the community. Let's work in small groups and the whatever it is that, and sit with it, and you employ our protocols of decision making, and sit, those days long meetings that our councils, like that was how they made decisions, and that means they it was serious. Like they took the time. It wasn't like people didn't have jobs then. They had jobs, they had to figure that out, but they were in council for days at a time, taking on the deep responsibility of our community. And I think like that's where we have to be, like that's the energy I want to bring to it, because that's who we are as well.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I agree. It kind of brings me back to the old stories about the chiefs, when they got together, when to decide who the main chief was going to be. And of course the women had already decided. And if the men didn't come out with the decision that they had made, when they went to get into their canoes, they couldn't find their paddles.
Right.
So
Yeah.
the women would, you're not getting your paddles till you make the right decision.
That sounds good. I mean, like but that's that's serious too, right? I mean, they had their own, like understanding the gender dynamics around this, understanding how we yeah. I mean, it's not going back in terms of like we're gonna do the same thing, but we're gonna embody that process in taking it seriously, the way our ancestors did. I think that's what I'm thinking. Like that's inspirational in my mind. That's not nothing. That's real important.
Yeah, it's like I'm just thinking as a storyteller, it's like as I write, the book you see has 1,000 or more pages of scrapped stuff I didn't use, and the book is still never perfect, but it's like I've taken the good parts and have kept them, right? And it's like we look back and it's like, let's grab those good parts. They may not be the best, right? But when we put it together, we have something. And I'm a chronic reviser, so I go back even later and look at stuff that I've published, and I'm like, oh, this is no wrong, wrong, you know. And it's just that matter of persistence in something, right? That matter of going back and taking the good and putting it into place, into practice. And it's about not being settled is the most important thing, right? Like, you know, not you could be settled for a bit, but you have to be unsettled enough to constantly keep going with it. And that can be hard for a lot of people who are in positions of, you know, disparity, right? Where they don't have, a certain amount of income, they don't have the time, you know, that's another large, huge factor that's at play. But I agree with you, Darren. It's like, yeah, you know, reaching back and, you know, grabbing those things and what you had said as well, Donna, you know, grabbing those things and putting them, thinking about them, evaluating them, and putting them in like a little bullet point list, and then like, all right, we're going to use this in some way, maybe, right? And we're basically creating a story for the future,
Well, you
like
know
what
what?
that is.
I think that this blood quantum stuff has basically taken the decision of our identity away from us. We need to take that back. We need to define who we are. That's what I think. I want to thank our special guest, author Morgan Talte, and Professor Darren Ranko for being on the show today. We will continue this conversation with Morgan Talte next month when we will discuss his latest book, Fire Exit. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Donna Loring, and you've been listening to Wabanaki Windows. The music for our show is by Rolf Richter, a track called Little Eagles from his CD Dreamwalk. The engineers for our show are Jessica Lockhart of WMPG and John Mann of WERU. Tune in again next month for another Wabanaki Windows.